everyone, I'm Troy Dodds, and welcome to the On The Record podcast presented by The Western Weekender. On this podcast, I'm joined by special guests who all have such great stories to tell about Penrith and the role they've played in our city. They are Penrith stories told by Penrith people. Today, my special guest is Alan Whittaker. Alan is an accomplished author covering a whole range of topics, including sport, history, biography, and true crime. He lives in Penrith. His list of achievements is long and varied. I really hope you enjoy our chat. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Troy.
First question we always ask, where and when were you born and where did you grow up?
Well, I'm Penrith born and bred, Nepean Hospital, and I lived across the road from the hospital on Park Street, went to local schools, St Nick's, St Dom's, and we were really a very much a Penrith family. Very lucky that my grandparents lived next door to us on either side of us.
Okay.
My parents grew up next to each other. When they got married, my grandparents subdivided. So we had a great childhood growing up next door to both sets of parents. So if we got into trouble, we could just sort of pair off and head off. My grandfather, Keach, ran the corner shop on the corner of Derby and Parker Street.
Wow, okay.
And my other grandfather ran the timber yard next door. So very much in the heart of Penrith.
Absolutely. And what about your parents? What did they do?
Well, Dad was a truck driver, had his own courier business in the 70s. Mum was a stay-at-home mum, having five kids under the age of six.
Wow.
A good Catholic family. And but she also, as we got older, branched out, worked in different outlets. Was the voice of Grace Brothers Penrith on the switch and on the service, and then had a very late career as Mrs. Claus.
Okay.
She loved that. She did that for about 5 or 6 years. And the number of people who have come up to me, especially being a former school teacher, saying, "Is this your mum with my kid on their knee at Christmas?"
Yeah.
Was amazing. So look, they're still in Penrith. They live near Jemison Park. They've moved out of Parker Street because of the hospital. That's our original house is still standing, but
okay.
It's all been bought up by all the doctors and will
right,
probably be
okay.
demolished one day.
Pretty cool, though, they can still go by and see the house.
It's still there, the old weatherboard. Yeah. I'm glad Mum and Dad moved out because the upkeep of it would have been quite hard. But, Penrith's changed since I was a kid. It was like a big country town. My mum and dad both came from the country. Dad was born in Hardin-Murrumburra, grew up in Tumut. His father was a publican. They came to Penrith after the war, and then Mum and Dad, Mum's family lived, they were dairy farmers on Castle Ray, the Keach family, very well known. I think there's a Keach Street out at Cranbrook somewhere, former mayor of Penrith in the 20s. They moved up to Wingham Taree to run a dairy farm and also came back after the war. Lived next door to each other. My parents were teenagers, got married, had a bunch of kids, and still together after 65 years. Still here.
Yeah, and you grew up in, so 1960s, 1970s Penrith. So what's Penrith like? You mentioned big country town.
It was.
Take us back to a high street in 60s and 70s Penrith.
Well, high street, you knew every business, especially my grandfather being a shopkeeper and my other grandfather being a timber merchant. Everybody knew everyone. So Shoeback's news agency and Upton's pharmacy. Not only did you know their names, but, you know, they were family friends. They used to come over and have barbecues on the weekend. But growing up in Penrith, our best friends were our cousins. We were very close to our cousins, the Whittakers, the Flints, the Oateses, the Crosses. They were our little bubble. Tim Sheens is a second cousin. That's how how smaller place Penrith was in those days. But Parker Street, where I lived, was had dirt edges. They didn't turn it into a freeway until the early 70s. You could ride your bike to school. We walked everywhere. We were young and fit. Probably in summer, the epicenter of Penrith was Penrith Pool.
Yep.
Nobody had a backyard pool in those days.
Yeah.
So we'd all meet, all our friends would all meet at Penrith Pool. And then during winter, Jemison Park was the place to go, you know, for footy matches. Cricket in the summer, soccer was just sort of starting at the time. But Penrith, even in the 60s and 70s, because of the Panthers, was very much a rugby league town.
Yeah, absolutely. And what kind of student were you? And did you, as a high school student, sort of, you know, see your future career in as an author, as a teacher that you became? What kind of avenue were you looking at during high school?
Look, going to Catholic schools in the 60s and 70s, your options were very limited. You know, growing up in Penrith, most kids left at year 10 to go into apprenticeships. Mm. And in fact, when I went on and did my HSC, there was only 50 in our class at St Dominic's. And I don't want to say we felt like failures, but we felt like, you know, I'm not ready for the big world. You know, I certainly wasn't hands-on with tools or anything.
Yeah. It's flipped around, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah. And now everyone goes to year 12. But I remember, look, a very interesting part of social engineering happened in the 70s. I'll get that in a sec. As a student, look, I was a B student. Flashes of brilliance and often mediocrity and just happy to go with the crowd. But I was a very artistic kid. I loved painting as a kid. I used to go up to my grandparents next door and just, you know, close off a room and just, I'd paint. I kept scrapbooks. I wrote about rugby league even as a 10-year-old. Mm. I kept all the stats. And I was just a bit of a rugby league nerd. So probably the best pathway out of that was a teaching scholarship. And the bit of social engineering that happened in the mid-70s, in those days you got scholarships. They paid you to go to Teachers College. Yep. The next big thing that happened was Kingswood Teachers College, Nepean Teachers College, opened at Kingswood in 1977. That was a year after my HSC. So what happened was a bunch of inspectors, public school inspectors, came out to our school and scouted prospective future teachers. And looking back on it, it was ingenious. You know, we're going to get Western Sydney kids, train them to be teachers, and we're going to put them in Western Sydney schools and teach the new generation of kids. And all the mates, and then when I went to Teachers College, I got a scholarship. I did fairly well in my HSC. When I went to Teachers College, we had over 20 males in our year, mainly females, probably about 80 females, but 20 males. And I still see many of those guys. They're all retiring now because we've all hit 60. But they became assistant principals like I did, principals, inspectors themselves. And they socially engineer that new generation of kids coming through. And I thought it was really good. But teaching for me was a fallback because I wanted to do journalism.
Yep. Okay.
And so I applied for a cadetship at the Sydney Morning Herald. The day after I finished my English exam for the HSC, I went to the Sydney Morning Herald and did an exam, had to wait 6 weeks for the results, had an interview, felt like a fish out of water, you know, Penrith boy in the big city. And I missed out because there was 1,000 applicants.
Wow.
And in the end, they put on 2 copy boys, not even cadet journalists.
Okay.
So you had to be a copy boy for 12 months. So feeling quite sorry for myself, I thought, well, what am I going to do next year? I had no idea. And then the scholarship came through.
Mm.
So that was great for me. It gave me 3 years. In those days, you did a 3-year course. It gave you 3 years to grow up. I met my future wife there. I still had lunch with 3 of our college mates. They had a very good football side. They won 2 university cups.
Yep.
And it was just a great time. Great time to be in Penrith. Great time to be growing up in the 70s. The music was good. The films were great. And it just allowed me, I suppose, to put into practice some of those writing skills I'd used later on.
Mm.
But there were still very limited avenues. You know, you don't get to 18 and 19 and 20 and say, I want to be a writer. I only started writing because I loved rugby league so much.
Yep.
And the other passion that I had as a kid was the Beatles.
Okay.
You know, pining for the Beatles to get back together again in the 70s. Well, you couldn't write about the Beatles. Now there are a million Beatles books.
Yeah.
At that time, there was nothing published about the Beatles.
Yeah, okay.
So it was just natural to start writing rugby league columns and rugby league matches and rugby league interviews and sending them off hoping that they get published. That's how I started.
And so that essentially became your side gig, I guess.
It was to
teaching. You know, and it's interesting you sort of, that story, I'm a little bit aligned with that in that the day after I finished my HSC, I landed a gig because I was writing my own sort of rugby league stuff on a personal website that was just starting to annoy a few people at the height of the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
And they ended up buying that site for $1 and then employing me as a journo. I had no idea what I was doing, but I'd written, as you say, about rugby league, and I used to have the trading cards and I'd move the emblems and do my own table on the on the kitchen table, the latest ladder every week and whatever else. And it does get ingrained in you.
We had no internet, of course, in the 70s, so it was the old cut and paste.
Yeah.
And so what I was doing, I was writing articles, trying to send them off, trying to get published. And I got published in the Sydney Morning Herald, ironically. The telly took some of my stats.
And did you know you were getting published to them, or was it a matter of, I'm going to pick up the paper and see if they've run my
stuff? No, they would contact back and say, oh, we'd like to publish this piece. But, you know, they used to say, look, we've got 10 journos here. I can't be giving you work outside the journos. Yeah. But it was just a hunger. And look, in the 80s, Penrith were coming good. Tim Sheens had come in. We'd made the semi-finals in 85, so there was a real buzz after the lethargy of the 70s, which was just like a black hole of bad performances. And so there was a real movement around rugby league publications. Ian Heads was just starting out. Mm. Gary Lester started his own publishing company. The first annual came out in 87. And all of a sudden, people were saying, well, Can you write a biography? Can you write the history of the grand finals? Can you do a book on first grade players, and we'll call it the encyclopedia? I just started getting these side gigs, and I was very lucky. I was probably doing one book a year for about 5 years, and then for the next 5 years, I did nothing.
Yeah, okay.
I actually left teaching. I was married with a young son, and a publisher said, come and work for me. He went broke. Had to go back to teaching with my tail between my legs. Yeah. Our daughter was born. But what I was doing at school was computers were just coming in. So after school, I'd sit on the computer and write up all my stats.
Yeah.
So I was able to just keep it burning. Mm. And then in the 90s, I had a run. I ghosted Terry Lamb's biography. My book on the grand finals came out. I did the Encyclopedia of Rugby League Players, which became a little bit of a Bible.
Yes.
In the pre-internet days, did that with a lovely guy called Glenn Hudson, who was a statistician from St. Mary's. I
think we might have one sitting on the shelf somewhere here, potentially.
And even though there's a lot of errors in it, I look back on it and I shake my head.
Yeah.
It was the first book to come out of its kind.
Yeah.
And it sort of started a lot of conversations.
I'll ask you about errors and things like that later on, because I know that it must be a difficult challenge when you're dealing with history, because people's versions of history change. But let's go back to your first book. So is officially listed as The History of the Balmain Tigers.
Yeah.
1988, a year before their probably almost most famous grand final, even though they didn't win it. Why the Balmain title? Was that someone that approached you? It was obviously you're a Penrith boy.
Yeah, no, a guy called Greg Anderson and I had just done our bachelor's degrees at night. Mm-hmm. We're both young married guys, no kids yet. And we'd done that for 3 years at night. And we just said to each other, wouldn't it be great to spend the next year doing something fun?
Yeah.
Panthers made the semis that year, and it was actually Greg's idea. Greg said, let's do a history of the Panthers. And I said, well, it's a pretty sad old history, but it's got a good finish.
Yeah.
So we actually, the first book we did was The History of the Panthers. We showed it to Roger Cowan. He liked it, but as with everything, they're not publishers. They didn't want to put any money into it. But a guy from the city had just published Ian Heads' book on South Sydney with the little column of stats and another column just talking generally about the season. And he said, well, let's do the Penrith book in that format. So we can't believe it. How easy is this? We've got ourselves published. And he said, meantime, can you do a book on North Sydney?
Yep.
So Greg and I did North Sydney together, and then Greg was too busy, got a promotion, and then the publisher said, can you do the Balmain Tigers? So they actually came out in reverse order. So Balmain came out first, North Sydney came out later that year, Penrith dropped the ball, never came out. And that's a bit of a burning passion with me, that the one book that I wanted to write at the beginning of my career is the one that never got published.
Yeah.
But once I got those published, I left teaching for 12 months, went back to teaching. And it took me 3 years, but I wrote a history of the grand finals. I was fascinated by the grand finals and the grand final history, there was no book on it. And I just sent the manuscript out to 10 publishers. I got one reply and it got published. And that's how the momentum started.
How difficult for you to say, when you talk of Balmain and North Sydney, who are both, you know, foundation clubs, to go back into their history when a lot of people, you know, there'd be very few people who are around from those early days. But as I mentioned earlier, the history would be quite clouded. You're dealing, I guess, in old newspaper stories, which may or may not be 100% accurate. Different versions of history.
Yeah.
So when you haven't lived a history, how do you sort of approach that?
We were lucky that both clubs, Balmain and North Sydney, even Penrith, had, you know, boxes of old ledgers and annuals. And there used to be a published annual because they're a business. They've got to publish how much money they make and who played so many games. And even though the stats were wobbly, there's a lot of good history there. But the one thing that drew me to rugby league writing wasn't the stats. I'm not a statistician.
Mm.
It was the stories and going and visiting Frank Hyde and Keith Barnes and even for Penrith, Dave Appleby and Bobby Boland, who I grew up with Bobby living around the corner, and his son and I are still great mates. Going and hearing their stories of what actually happened and then weaving those into the story. Those personal interviews, you know, the old big tape deck, the story, no microphone, talking to a tape deck and then transcribing. You would know yourself, you're still doing that now.
Yeah.
You're just doing it all digitally.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was part of the fun, just going. And I met all my heroes. You know, I did a book on South Sydney, and even though I wasn't a Souths fan, to sit with Eric Sims and John Sattler and Bobby McCarthy, just fantastic fellows.
Yeah.
And I find that generation, you know, it's good to have heroes, and they say don't meet your heroes, but that older generation, they're very gentlemanly. They're very respectful of the fact that you want to hear their story. They invite you into their home. Their wives give you tea and bickies. And it's really, I look back on those days of traveling around in the pre-internet days and doing all that legwork as some of the best times I've had in publishing.
Yeah.
So it's really building it up from the ground up. Then, of course, when everything became on the internet, you realise that, you know, you didn't score 3 tries. It was only 2. And this guy's name was wrong. But look, even David Middleton makes mistakes and makes corrections in his annuals. So, unfortunately, the record keeping of different clubs, you know, for years Penrith didn't count replacement players.
Yeah.
So a guy like Jeff Gerrard, oh, he played 305 games. He actually played about 330.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because they didn't count when he came onto the field.
Right.
They counted him as a reserve grade player.
Right.
So,
well, it's funny
that's been
that.
Frustrating.
Yeah, it's funny you say that too, because you mentioned Encyclopedia of Rugby League Players, which has been published a few times, 1993 the first time. But clubs these days, they are so on it as far as, you know, numbers. You are Panther number 595, or you're, you know, Rabbitoh number 1007. They're really into that. But back then, and you mentioned sort of putting out that book for the first time, there was really just nowhere you could go to say, well, this guy says he's played, you know, half a dozen first grade games, where is he? And I can remember, I guess, the continuous call team, which is like, you know, obsessive listening during the 90s, would often refer to that book.
Yeah.
You know, that would be how they'd refer
They loved
you know,
it.
Yeah.
They loved it. Look, it was a guide. That's all it was. And yeah, some of it was embarrassing. The most embarrassing thing, if you have a look at that first volume, I say that Andrew Johns is the son of Les Johns.
Okay.
Because he had just come into first grade and he said that as a joke the week before we went to publication, and I wrote it in.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I met Les Johns years later, and he goes, oh, you wrote the encyclopedia. Could you explain to my wife where my son comes from? Because he's not my son. I said, I know. It's so embarrassing. But look, you know what it's like. Sometimes you just got to publish and be damned.
Yeah.
But I got, I published Ian Collis's A to Z of Rugby League many years later. And not only did his database, the Fox Sports database, have inaccuracies. They spelt my cousin Rod Whittaker, who played 6 games for Penrith, they spelled his last name wrong.
Okay.
So everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah, and
so,
it's still, Panthers are still correcting things now. Often in the list of players, I'll say, well, look, I've got this player as this, and you've got him as this, and then there'll be an explanation of some bizarre thing that's happened along the way. They've had to add players at different points.
Well, I had a lot of mates over at Cambridge Park who were the gun side in the 70s. They'd play on a Sunday. They'd go to Penrith Park, sit on the bench for third grade, sit on the bench for second grade. A couple of them even ran on in first grade in the last 10 minutes as a replacement player. Yeah. They're not credited. Roy Simmons told me that story too. I said, oh, you made your debut against blah, blah, blah in 1980. He goes, no, I didn't. He said, I made my debut against Souths. I ran on for the last 5 minutes and we were down 58-5.
Yeah.
I made two tackles, one run. But it's not credited.
Yeah, wow.
So there's always going to be those personal stories and discrepancies, but you do get the odd player. I got a lot of mail when I published that first book saying, I didn't play six games for Cronulla. I played 16.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well,
and that even happens now when you know, maybe a player passes away or something like that, and you go to a few great resources that are around. Yes, the traditional books, but also Rugby League Project, which is a great. And sometimes you've got three different answers as to how many games they played and who they played for and what year they went. And it's just a, you know.
You've got to check because I've read so many stories where a player says, I scored two tries in a grand in a grand final. And you go, well, that's the easiest stat to check. Don't write it.
They
didn't even score in that grand final.
Yeah.
They're confusing something else.
Yeah,
so you've got to be very diligent and very careful what you publish.
Your first sort of six, seven books are rugby league, but then you write a book on Jimmy Barnes.
Well, what happened? How did that come about? Yeah, that was a weird one. So I was, you know, doing a book probably every 2 years. You know, it just wasn't getting any traction at all. And my publisher, I went and saw him about my next book, and he was pulling his hair out. He goes, oh, I've just paid Jimmy Barnes all this money. And this is 20 years ago, before Jimmy wrote his two best-selling biographies.
Yeah.
I've just paid Jimmy Barnes all this money, and he won't take my calls, and he won't... I sent a young writer around and he won't answer the door and whatever. And I said, I'll do it for you. And I wasn't a Jimmy Barnes fan. Mm. I'm definitely a 70s Britpop fan, not an Australian pub band fan. And I said, but I'll do it for you because having ghosted Terry Lamb's biography and Roy Simmons's biography, I knew how to ghost. I knew how to tape, you know, cut out all the ums and ahs, put it in a logical sequence.
Yeah.
And get the voice of the person. I said, I'll do that for you. And he goes, oh, I thought you only did rugby league stuff. And I said, no, I'm trying to do other stuff as well. So I contacted Jimmy's manager. He gave me his address. I just went around and knocked on the door and said, I'm Alan from Gary Allen Publishers. They've contracted you to do this book. We're going to do 10 interviews. We're going to write this book. And he went, oh, okay, rightio. Come in. Treated me like a long-lost son. We only did 5 interviews.
Okay.
And every second interview was, I'm not telling you that story, I'm saving that for my big book. And I'm glad that he did finally get it. But that was my first breakaway from rugby league. And then another publisher said, well, I saw that you did Jimmy Barnes's book. You know, is there anything else you want to write about? And I said, I'd love to write about true crime.
This is my next question, because you write about a story that actually I'm pretty fascinated about.
Everyone
read this book as well.
Podcasts.
The Wanda Beach murders. So was that a story? Was that as a true crime story? Was that a story you were already fascinated about?
Absolutely. Having grown up in the 60s and 70s, you know, my older cousins were Penrith surfies. So they'd get the surfboard at Penrith Station, catch the train to Cronulla.
Yeah.
Because Cronulla is the only beach accessible by train.
Mm.
Can't get to the northern beaches by train
from
Penrith. And they'd come back and they'd tell you these stories. You know, two girls were found murdered in the beach at Wanda, and nobody knows what happened to them. And you grow up with these horror stories, you know, a bit like, nightmare stuff. Mm. And you go, well, what happened there? And then in the 70s and early 80s, there was a person in jail, in a mental prison, who was stringing the police along saying, I murdered the two girls at Wanda Beach, and he was painting paintings and putting little clues in the paintings and sending them to the coppers, and the police felt that he was the man. So I thought, well, we know all this. It's almost became a public myth. So I said to my publisher, I'd really like to write a book on the Wanda Beach, and they said, well, you've got runs on the board now of Jimmy Barnes, off you go and write it. And I said to my wife, how do you do it? You know, you just can't go to the newspapers.
Yeah.
A lot of the people were already passed away. It was 40 years after the crime. And luckily, Karen came home from work one day and said, oh, Russell Oxford says hello. And I said, who's Russell Oxford? She said, oh, you taught his kid about 5 years ago. And I said, oh, yeah, good kid. Well, Russell was head of unsolved crime for New South Wales Police, and he said, and Karen mentioned to him, "Oh, Alan's doing a book on the Wanda Beach murders," and he said, "I'll get him the case files." Wow. So I was actually acting principal at the height of my teaching career at Baulkham Hills when Russell rang up and he goes, "Are you there?" And he brought in two boxes, you know, 6 feet high, of all the original case files, all the original interviews, autopsy reports, crime scene reports, unfortunately crime scene photos. And from that body of work, I took 3 months off work and I wrote the book, and that was my first true crime book. And that led to then the Beaumont Children book that I wrote about, because those two crimes were linked, even though they're separate crimes. And rather than branching off and becoming an expert in true crime, I wrote a book on 12 crimes that shocked the nation, which was 12 iconic Australian crimes. And then I did a book on Derek Percy, who was this, at the time in the early 2000s, the longest serving inmate in Victorian history. He was jailed for murdering a poor young girl in Melbourne, but they were trying to find out whether he did Wanda and Beaumont. And he was like, you know, the great white whale of unsolved child murders. He wasn't, but I spent a year investigating him too. So I like to think of myself not as being an expert on true crime, although I am, as you are, I'm quite fascinated by the power of podcasts. And
I mean, that hasn't that chat, like, you know, when you're first writing some of those writing, true crime books.
But I'm only an expert on probably three crimes, and I'd rather that be the case than be a talking head talking about all sorts of different stuff.
It's pretty amazing how that genre has become, you know, as far as both documentaries in the streaming world and in podcasts.
Well, Teacher's Pet changed the law, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And got, the person responsible, who was a former footballer, by the way, got him jailed. So it does have a power. And I think, you know, the research says that young women are the main audience of true crime stories, and it's quite titillating.
Yeah, it's a fascinating world, I guess, because for most people it's a world that they don't inhibit, but that, you know, you can almost put yourself in if you have a few scary thoughts, I guess, you know.
So by about 2008, and I'd been an assistant principal in various schools for 10 years, I didn't want to become a principal because that takes 100% of your time, and I was really enjoying my writing. I came at a cross in the road where I had to choose one or the other, and my ex-publisher, who'd went to another company, in the end, I took a year off and I was lecturing at UWS, which I really enjoyed. You know, she said, "Why don't you come and be a commissioning editor and a publisher for me, find authors." And I said, "Look, I only do that 3 days a week because I still want to write." So I worked for her 3 days a week, and I worked for myself 3 days a week, and published over 200 books for her in a 7-year period, but I also wrote about 30 books for myself.
So to wrap up the teaching side of things, when do you finish teaching? When does teaching
end? Well, 2011 was the last year, but I knew by about my mid-40s, my writing career was taking off. I was taking a lot of long service leave and leave without pay to do the writing. Yep. And, you know, and a few people, including my bosses, were pointing out, "You're going to have to make a choice soon."
Yeah.
But there's no real pathway to earn a living as an author in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, Richard Flanagan.
Yeah.
There's a handful of people. And the rest earn $10,000 a year. So you can't raise a family on it. But when my publisher said, "Come and work for me," and, you know, 3 days a week was sort of like a base salary, and then whatever I generated through my own writing balanced that up. You know, in the end, looking back on it, I sacrificed a whole career and a lot of money to pursue the writing. But, you know, I'm still writing now at 65. Yeah. I've been writing for 40 years, so it was the right way to go. But the funny thing is, I spent 30 years in the classroom teaching kids. You know, a week after I joined the new company, I was in London, in their London office, finding authors on Edgware Road outside of Hyde Park.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like whiplash from the head spin. So it was a really exciting career move, and I met a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting authors, and did that until I reached 60 and then decided, well, hang on, it's time for me to get back to what my first love, which is writing.
Mm.
And now I'm semi-retired, but I still just pick projects that I really want to work on. I've got the luxury of no deadlines now. I can, because I say this, I get contacted by a lot of people, how do I get published? The golden ticket to publishing is a finished manuscript.
Yeah.
So I like to finish a manuscript and then go with a finished idea, rather than saying to an author, to a publisher, oh, I've got this idea in my head, and do you want to pay me some money for the next 18 months to write it? Most say no.
I was going to ask you, you mentioned the financial element there. Bit of inside baseball, I guess, but how does it work? If you're not a Britney Spears and a David Beckham getting paid you know, astronomical amounts to put out a book, are you being paid a portion in advance to write a book? Do you get a percentage of sales? How does that all work? You know, when we hear about a best-selling book, how much of a difference does that make, or is it really more about the next book and how much you're getting paid for that?
Yeah, it's really like a big boulder rolling down a hill sometimes. So I always say to prospective authors, if you've got no clout, if you've got no track record, you've got no leverage, but I always ask for an upfront advance on royalties, because once my backside's in the sling and I've got to produce a book and I've taken their money, and it might be something as little as $3,000. My biggest advance I ever received was $10,000, which was a lot of money. Paid for a lot of traveling and a lot of expenses. And in those days, I did have it, you know, in the pre-internet days. But now everything's on the internet. Newspapers are on the internet. I don't have to go to Mitchell Library and go through microfiche. That stuff should be burnt, destroyed. Spent countless hours, you know, flicking through old newspapers. So everything's on the internet now. So you don't need those big expanses. I have to go and travel someone. I've never had a researcher. I don't pay other people like, say, Peter Fitzsimons does to do his legwork. You do it yourself. So that advance is on a royalty. And look, in the old days when I first started, it was a buck a book. You know, you're lucky to get a dollar a book. Now you might get $2.50 to $3 a book. But the average print run in Australia is only 3,000 copies. In the golden days of publishing, you could sell 10,000. I once sold 50,000 copies of this book, Speeches That Defined the World. Slightly after the internet, it became the graduation present to go to.
I was going
to
say, it's a very gift book, isn't
50,000 copies sold. I was able to take a year off teaching and write full time. So now it's more like 3,000 copies. I like to take an advance so that if I don't get any royalties, at least it's a non-refundable advance. I used to take, say, $5,000, and if I don't get 5,000 in royalties, I haven't wasted my time. But look, I'm just happy just to be working, and you know, I'm happy to be working for a couple of publishers who ring up and say, what do you want to do? I'm doing horse racing now, which I love, and I've got a real deep affection for. But rugby league is the first the first love. True crime, I've sort of moved away from that because everything's gone on podcasts. Also, the New South Wales Police have tightened up their media unit. They won't give you anything. I had the inside running to do the Lynette Dawson case 10 years ago, and it got shut down by New South Wales Police. I had the detective on site. He was a rugby league player. I had all these former colleagues ready to talk about him. I wouldn't have done as good a job as Hedley Thomas did on his podcast because he started from the ground up. But I did write Hedley and say, look, I was going to work on this book, but I'm glad that you got the story out, and I'm glad that you got some cooperation from the police. And he wrote back to me, he goes, I got no cooperation. He said, I had to go and find everybody myself. Good old detective work. So all power to him. Got a great result. It's probably not the best way to go. From a legal point of view, it's very hard. And they thought, well, he'll get off now because there's too much in the public domain. But the court's got their man, which is all you can ask for. So I'm a big fan, being a baby boomer, having grown up in the 70s, I'm a big fan of pop culture. So I did a book on classic albums. I've done a book on the Beatles, British Invasion. I want to do a book on Oscar-winning movies, getting ready for the 100th anniversary in 2027. But a lot of those pop culture things that we once valued, you know, the vinyl album, Oscar-winning movies.
On their way back?
They're on their way back, but they've gone out of fashion. Yeah. You know, they're not pop culture icons anymore.
Yeah.
Like the Oscars have gone through a whole rebranding now.
Yeah.
You know, not diverse enough. Controversy, who's voting?
Yeah.
How do these films...
Yeah, they don't necessarily mean as much as...
No, it doesn't mean as much. And that is the plight of the aging baby boomer.
Yeah.
Is the stuff that we valued in the 70s, the vinyl album, popular music, everything's changed.
I mean, I grew up with parents who loved the Beatles as well, Cliff Richard, that kind of era of music. And I mean, I had my late dad's Blu-ray and DVD collection in my garage. It was still on display, but I don't think I've watched anything from that in 5-6 years.
It's all online.
It's all online.
Go on YouTube.
I can find every single one of those things, probably. Maybe not, but pretty much all of them somewhere on there. His record collection is at home with Mum. I don't know the last time she would have put on a vinyl. And even though we talk about the vinyl resurgence these days, we're talking $70 or $80 for a new album. So it's not quite the resurgence of collecting that it once was. It's more of a, you know, you love a particular artist and you want a couple of those records.
Well, you know, the Beatles are remastering. So, you know, you're buying the same albums you bought when they came out. Yeah. You know, that's the stupidity of it all. But, you know, being a baby boomer, collecting is very important. You know, I collected. I went on eBay and got all the footy cards from my childhood.
Yep.
And I got books that I read in the 70s.
It's a very painful conversation because I would love to do that because, one, I remember I was about maybe just moved out of home. My dad rang and said, "What do you want me to do with all these footy cards?" I said, "I'll just get rid of them. I don't want them anymore." And I think back now, I'm like, "Why didn't I decide to keep them? I had everything. I collected every year." And
it's amazing, amazing the market and the industry about it. But I also like just talking, and this is why it's great chatting to you. But I like talking to collectors, and I like talking to people who have a passion for something. And even though you might not share the passion, but everybody who grew up in the 70s, it was either music, footy cards, footy annuals, Big League magazine, Rugby League Week. That was the Bible, the weekly Bible. And they're all gone. They're gone the way of the dodo. But that's life, you know. You don't despair what's changed. You just enjoy the journey.
So that's an interesting take on it. As someone who grew up with Big League and Rugby League Week, you accept that they have to go. It's a shame, though, that we don't see, you know, even a Big League in Grand Final Week or something like that to...
I used to collect all the Grand Final Week editions, and I've still got them up until they folded. But I think, you know, young people today, they're reading online. You know, my son's in his mid-30s and, you know, hasn't read a book since high school because he's always on his phone. He just reads on his phone. And, you know, the disposability of magazines and that sort of stuff, people don't collect. So I'm going through, you know, trying to downsize, get rid of stuff. I think I've halved my book collection because as a publisher, I collected books from all around the world.
Yeah.
You know, I drove 6 boxes of books down to Brother Books and donated them to charity in Melbourne, you know, just to get rid of stuff. So I'm sending a lot of my old Rugby League collection just to younger collectors saying, not even selling it, just giving it away. Because at some point, you've got to get rid of it. You can't take it with you. Yeah. And I'd rather, having enjoyed stuff for 40 years, I'd rather a younger generation just enjoy it. You know, poor Mike Nesmith from the Monkees passed away, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get rid of those monkey cards that I've had for 20 years. So I sold them online. Yeah. It's just like end of an era, get rid of it, pass it on to a new generation.
I think I need to follow your lead. A lot of Panthers drawers, boxes, and sitting at home. You've written 50-odd books now, 55 books. Is there a favourite? Is there one that you kind of say, that was my absolute favourite to write and to put out?
Look, I really enjoyed the pop culture books that I wrote. I wrote a book on the British pop invasion, and I got some fantastic images from the Mirror in London. I was at the London Book Fair, and this guy came up. He goes, I'm the photo rep. We're trying to get these photos published. And I said, have you got British rock invasion from the 60s? He goes, yep. I said, well... consider yourself published. And that was great. And working for people overseas. I did a book on classic film. I'm a real film nerd. Put a lot of my, you know, my favourite films in there and tried to write authoritatively on that. Meeting some of the people, like Roy Simmons is a legend, Luke Lewis, I ghosted his biography, Matty Rogers, Terry Lambs was a lovely guy. You know, this is how simple it was in the 90s. Rang him up, do you want to do a book? Yep, come around for a beer. Shook hands, that was it. No no managers. Yeah. The good old days. But I think the one book that I've written that really resonates is that disappearance of the Beaumont children. Mm. Three children disappeared from a beach in Adelaide. I've been back to Adelaide many times. I went back to Adelaide with Channel 9 in 2018 when they did the factory dig. Myself and my friend Stuart Mullins, who is from Adelaide, and he's now just written his book on the whole journey. We felt we unmasked a good person of interest, gave all the information to the police. Police sat on it for 7 years. We went to the media. We named the guy. We still think that he's a person worth investigating, even though he's dead. These children disappeared almost 60 years ago now. And, you know, their legacy deserves to be resolved. Mm. So that's been a, you know, you write a book, 6 months later, you put it in the drawer, you forget about it. Yeah. That's been a 20-year journey. Still get people, the media, did a Mamma Mia podcast the other day on the Beaumont children. It's still something that resonates and needs to be resolved. And I'm hopeful before I depart the world that some answers will be forthcoming. But when you can write something that resonates with people, I think that's very gratifying. That people contact you and say, "Look, I read your book, and it really affected me."
Conversely, is there a book that you would look at and just cringe and just go, I don't want to see that. I just, you put it in the bottom of the drawer and take it off the bio list.
I'm pretty happy. I've never written a junk book just for the sake of getting my name on a book. Some of the Rugby League books, I think I did a top 10. Now, that would all be on the top 10 of Rugby League, and I talked the publisher into that. And, you know, that would be ideal for a website now. Yeah, so a lot of the books I published in the early days would just be classic website books. But no, look, I'm pretty proud of the fact that I could have been a one-trick pony and just written about rugby league, but crossing over into biography and then history, being a teacher, I'm a bit of a history nut, so having written books on speeches and famous events and published a lot of books, edited a lot of books in that area was a lot of fun. The pop culture books, you know, it's good to get your name on a good book. That was always the goal. The first goal was to get your name on a book. You know, those two magazines, the North Sydney book and the Balmain book, I thought they were the bee's knees. In 88, I look back on them now, I'm going, this is just cut and paste.
I think we all do that if you look back at an old Weekender and whatever else. But at the time, the day it came out, you're like, this is the greatest thing.
But they were cut and paste. They weren't done digitally. Yeah. You actually had to print off the words, cut it, glue it onto a master sheet, and then they took a photo of the master sheet.
Yeah.
You had to convert the photo to dot matrix, put the photo in place.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to Greg Anderson, who not only did we write the North Sydney book, we laid it out. I just said, this is scrapbook for grown-ups. Yeah. This is all it is. You know, thank God for computers and computerization. I'm also glad that I was there at the start of Rugby League publications. You know, I think Steve Mortimer did a book, Price did a book, then The Annual came out, and then I came out. So I was right there at the birth of Rugby League literature, if that's not an oxymoron. And from 88 up until probably the early 2000s, that was the golden period where everybody bought a book out. There were some really good books on history. Ian Collis and I, you know, did that book on Rugby League clubs, which sold 30,000 hardback.
Yeah.
You know, it was really an exciting time, and it's good to look back on it. But like all good writers, I'm looking for my next publication. I've been working on a novel for 5 years.
Okay.
May never see the light of day. I'd love to do a screenplay on a couple of ideas I've got. I'd love to turn the Beaumont children into a screenplay. And I've now got the time to potter around and No deadlines, no publisher yelling at you. Just get the work done and enjoy the work.
And apart from those projects, you have, from a when we were talking the other day, you still have four or five books in the pipeline for the next couple of years.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, 90s Rugby League.
Yeah, got a book coming out next year with Rockpool Publishing called Power and the Passion, Rugby League in the 80s. You know, talking about the great Parramatta and Canterbury sides.
Yep.
Some great photos in there. I've just finished a book, not unlike the encyclopedia, called The Blues, which is basically 320 biographies of every New South Wales player.
Okay.
But coming from a quirky angle, not just saying, you know, how many games they played and how many tries. The encyclopedia did that. But, you know, what's their motivation? You know, writing Nathan Cleary's chapter the other night, you know, the Prince of Penrith is now the king.
Yeah.
You know, trying to find that hook. That's what interests me, finding interesting things to say. But getting published is hard. I do get a lot of inquiries. I had one last night from someone ringing me saying, how do I get published?
Mm.
And if I can pass on a little bit of information, it is difficult to get published. It is like winning the lottery, but don't expect a big cash prize.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Having got your name on a book, the idea very soon is get your name on a book that matters.
Yeah.
And get your book on a name that sells. Because not all of them do.
We mentioned mistakes before, errors. And I think, you know, being in publishing myself, we all kind of know that pit of the stomach feeling when it's picked up, you know.
Too late.
And then eventually, you know, it subsides and, well, you live it and you live the errors that exist. Are there any that stand out? I know you mentioned one earlier, the Les Johns,
and Andrew Johns.
But others that, and as I mentioned earlier, I guess, you know, history is clouded because people's versions of events can differ. You know, a newspaper you might research from 1954 might have got it wrong. And, you know, you don't know that they corrected it or didn't correct it.
Absolutely. Look, I'm lucky now that I've got very good editors around me, but it's Murphy's Law of publishing that as soon as you get the book in your hands, the first page you open, you'll see a typo.
Yeah.
My wife is an English teacher. She will spot a typo even if it's a comma in the wrong place from a mile away. It's very frustrating.
I was going to say, you used to say, don't read my books.
Well, she doesn't anymore because the first thing he goes, oh, there's an error on page 40. Don't tell, I don't want to know. I remember I wrote that book on the grand finals and... my memory failed me. I said that Tommy Radonikis was replaced by somebody late in the grand final against Parramatta in 81. And I actually had Tommy Radonikis ring me up and abuse me nicely. He found my number. I actually taught Tommy's son at Blacktown. So not that he remembered me, but, you know, I'm in the phone book. I'm easy.
Yeah.
I was easy to find. What are you saying? You know, Tommy, the gravelly voice. What are you saying? I got replaced. I never got replaced. And I said, I'm sorry, Tommy. I'll correct it in the next edition. Yeah. And that's all you can say. Yeah? Any mistakes, I'll correct. The Balmain book that we did, the first day I got it, they left out half the internationals. They only had the internationals post-war. They didn't have the early internationals. Okay. And I thought, oh, God, how did that happen? I once published a book. I didn't write it, but I published it, and half the index was left out.
Right.
You know, and... My managing director was not very happy, but they're the sort of things that happen. We published a book on a crime, a very controversial crime. It was written by a former lawyer in Melbourne. The day the book came out, Victorian courts put a suppression order on any publication of the guy's name because he was up for another murder.
Right.
And we had to frantically, the boxes had just gone out.
Yeah.
We had to frantically recall every bookshop and return them. And we still almost got fined $100,000 because someone bought a copy of the banned book in an op shop that had got through the cracks. But we appealed to the court and said, look, this, we made every endeavour to return the calls. So publishing, as you know, from a weekly job is fraught with danger.
Yeah.
The important thing... that I've always maintained, you know, my underlying principle is do no harm.
Mm.
You know, don't slag anybody off. Terry Lamb told me that. He said, yeah, I'll write a book with you, but I won't bag anyone. I won't bag any first grade player. I won't call him a cat because anyone who plays first grade has shown their medal. And, you know, never knock a champion. Never knock Brad Fittler because he's down.
Yeah.
Never knock, you know, Penrith. Never knock a champion.
Yeah.
So I've always tried to be honest, but not be controversial. You know, I'm not Ray Hadley. I'm not trying to bag somebody out to get an edge. Plus, I never played the game. You know, I'm a fan. I love the game. I want to promote it. So, you know, those sort of principles. Try and be honest. Never write anything, you know, that slags somebody out. If something goes wrong, be honest about it. But it is, you're not going to please everybody. And I've had a few interesting phone calls over the years. But on the whole, it's been very, very enjoyable. And I'm hoping that the next 5 years are just as enjoyable.
Absolutely. You mentioned your wife and kids. Tell us a bit about Karen and the kids.
Well, Karen's still teaching. She loves it. I couldn't wait to get out. I hit 50. I wanted to do writing. I went to UWS. I tried to lecture. I enjoyed that. But, you know, I really think it's a young person's game. But Karen is a specialist reading teacher at Marion and loves it. Goes to school with a smile on her face every day. Yep. So that's what every teacher should do. My kids have now grown up. Tim works for Penrith Council. He's a green space manager, does a lot of the parks, does a lot of the liaising with local sports groups, did a sports management degree at UWS. And my daughter, Melanie, works for Cumberland Health in the hospital system, in HR. She did her degree at UWS. So it was quite fun, both my kids being at UWS and Dad was lecturing. PDHPE. Mathematics education, primary education next door was good fun, and a brand new grandson, Harry.
Wow! Okay.
Yeah, so it's
congratulations.
It's a new generation. Still live in Penrith.
Yeah, and that's great. They've stayed in Penrith.
Look, they're locally. Tim's out at Silverdale. Mel's just moving away, but all my brothers. Oh, not all my brothers and sisters. I've got a sister in Melbourne, but all my family are here in Penrith. But Penrith's now a big place. We don't see them as much as we used to do. We run into them. A lot of my friends are still here. Still a great place to live, to bring kids up. Never regret of it. I don't care if I stay here forever. It's a great place to grow up. And, you know, the cosmopolitan Penrith. Mm. I had a friend come down from the Gold Coast. He's in HR himself. And he said he can't believe that... that food quarter at the Plaza, he goes, that's as good as anything on the Gold Coast. And we took him down to Tench Reserve and sat there and had a wine overlooking the river, and then went and got some dumplings from the Japanese place there. And he said, I can't believe how special this feels. Mm. And I get that vibe from Penrith. Penrith's a place on the move.
Yeah.
It's just becoming very hard to live here because hard to find new houses and hard to build. But for the people who are here, and we've got a winning football team.
Yeah, and obviously your love of the Panthers has continued. Enjoyed the three-peat over the last 3 years.
Would you believe I made a... I was very confident they could win it this year, but I made an educated decision to go overseas.
Yep.
My wife and I were driving through Ireland when they won the last premiership. I was pulling over on the way to Tipperary, of all places, every 20 minutes getting updates. At 24:08, I was ready to throw the phone out the window. How could this happen?
Yeah.
By the time we got to Tipperary, it was 24:20, and we pulled over into a car park. I got on YouTube, found a pirate feed, and watched the winning try and the celebration.
Wow.
And it was just as good as being there.
Yeah.
But it is. It's great. I actually ran into Liam Martin, who lives near us, on Melbourne Cup Day, and I said, look, don't want to bother you, don't want to annoy you, but congratulations on your success, and the whole community are behind you. You know, you've given everybody a lift, and he was a very gracious young man, said, thanks very much, I appreciate that, left him alone. And we should celebrate a really good group of people. They're brilliantly coached by Ivan. They've got a great team behind them. They mean a lot to a lot of young kids. I've got a lot of young nieces and nephews, and they've got kids, and they're all Penrith supporters. In the old days, they used to be Canterbury and Parramatta supporters, but everyone's got Penrith now, and I think it's a great thing for the local area.
Has Ivan ever done a book? Maybe
you should, No, look, Ivan would have a great story to tell, but I think he'll tell it at the end of the journey. He's still in the middle of the journey.
Yeah.
Nathan will have a great story to tell, but I loved his comment, we're only just starting.
Yeah.
You know, a long way to go. I think the Ivan Gus story would be a fantastic story.
Absolutely.
But I think Ivan will wait until the end of it to tell it.
Any more Penrith book, like, you know, you've written a lot of books, probably not as many Penrith books as one might expect. I know you wrote the Roy Simmons book and
I've always had a couple of ideas of doing books on the early days. I did a book called Mud, Blood and Beer, Rugby League in the 70s.
Yep.
And that was really a semi-biographical, being a Penrith supporter in the 70s when we won nothing.
Mm.
And I suppose growing above that. But today, the book would be a lot different. It would really be about the whole city's identity and how the city got behind.
Well, it feels like there is a gap there, because obviously the really great Panthers history book came out in Men in Black, but I think it finishes in maybe the late, maybe 2008, 2009, maybe a little bit longer. But
the one thing I
certainly
found
misses this era.
Yeah, I think there is a book about this era, especially the last, say, 5 years, you know, the second coming of Ivan. But I think the issue is that those lean years are very important. Frank Hyde used to say something, you know, those who drink the water should remember the people who dug the well.
Mm.
And, you know, we shouldn't forget the Bobby Bolands, the Laurie Fagans, the Dave Applebys, my heroes from the early days, the Reggie Waltons, because those were the guys that did it when we weren't winning.
Mm.
And they built the following. You know, there are so many people of my era who have been Penrith, you know, through thick and thin.
Yes.
Wouldn't even think of barracking for Parramatta just because they won all those premierships.
Yeah.
You know, the poor buggers are now waiting, 38 years for the next one. You got to stay the journey. And a lot of people my age have stayed the journey and are now enjoying the destination.
Absolutely. Last question, we always ask at the end, and it does stump some people, but how would Alan Whittaker like to be remembered?
As a good bloke, I think, as a good friend. I still have many friends from high school and primary school that I still speak to. We still catch up, you know, have lunch. From college, teachers' college. Rather than being a participator, I was an observer. I like to watch. I like to watch people. I'm a people watcher. Helps you as a writer. And, you know, as a good social friend, I like to be remembered as. There'd probably be a lot of ex-students who probably remember that guy. I remember that guy. He was a pain in the neck, a stickler for the rules. But we also had a lot of fun in the early days with kids and taking kids to basketball and footy. And, you know, I was down at Penrith Pool having a swim yesterday and the kids coming in. And I said to my brother, I did that for 20 years, you know, learned to swim with kids, organising swimming lessons for kids. And you look back on it and you think, yeah, it was good fun back in the days. You had a lot of autonomy about what you taught and how you taught. But, yeah, remembered as a good bloke and as a Penrith supporter, a loyal Penrith supporter.
Of course. Well, it's a fascinating story and still a lot to play out, of course, and some new books just around the corner. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Troy. Thanks for having me.
And I hope you enjoyed our chat. On the Record is produced by The Western Weekender. To hear future episodes, search Western Weekender wherever you listen to podcasts and make sure you hit subscribe. Check out westernweekender.com.au and we will see you next time.